Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Words, weapons, sharpened knives, makes you wonder how the other half died. Other half died.
Can't find one more word to say, so I'll just get on my way. I'm coming home. River wide, river deep, river running in my sleep.
Life to live over.
It's out of the question.
Oh, I know. I was just saying that if I did have my life to live over...
What would you do?
I would live a life filled, engulfed, consumed by lust.
You would?
Yes.
Engulfed.
Consumed.
With lust?
Yes.
Just walk through that door.
If you touch me, I can get off. We'll get off together.
See what I have for you?
It's all whipped, juicy. You see how the juice flows out of my heart, cunt?
I've done everything that I've been taught.
Doesn't that count for anything?
I'm sure you've pleased the master, but nothing can change. Ever.
Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary, and of course, joining me, co-host, Mr. Mike White.
I have nothing clever to say this week.
Well, you know, can't do it all the time. And joining us, special guest, co-host, and author of the book Golden Goddesses, Jill Nelson.
Hello.
All right.
Nice to be back.
Thanks for joining us. This week, we're talking about the 1973 adult film The Devil and Miss Jones. The film, directed by Gerard Damiano, stars Georgina Spelvin in the title role as an unhappy woman who kills herself, meets Mr. Abaca, a kind of gatekeeper to the other world who informs her that she can't go to heaven because of the suicide. So she makes a deal to return to Earth to truly earn her place in hell by experiencing all the sexual and sensual pleasure she can that she didn't have before she killed herself. But, of course, like any good deal with the devil, there is a price to pay. That's the basic outline of this adult classic that received some great reviews in its day, and for my money, I think it is a very impressive leap for the filmmaker from Deep Throat fame, Gerard Damiano, to The Devil and Miss Jones. And also, as Detroit boys, we thought this would be the perfect film in honor of Devil's Night. Now, those who don't know what Devil's Night is, the day before Halloween, during the really bad years of the arsons in Detroit, mostly in the 1980s, many, many homes were burned, up to 700 in one year during the three-day holiday weekend of Halloween. And if you want to know more about what it takes to fight fires in Detroit, I would recommend the new documentary, Burn. But since we're talking about The Devil and and Miss Jones. It is 40 years old. And, you know, we're going to get into spoiler territory on this episode, so I'm going to let you know in advance. I know you're probably like, it's an adult film. How can it have a twist ending? Well, it does. So if you want, turn off the podcast now. Go check out The Devil and Miss Jones if you haven't already, and come back, because don't worry, we'll be waiting for you. So as our guest, Jill, do you remember the first time you saw Devil and Miss Jones, and what were your thoughts?
I do. It's actually probably been about 3 years since I first watched it, and I rewatched it again a couple of weeks ago because I knew that we were going to be discussing it. I would say that, and this is truthful, out of all of the films that I watched for Goddesses, which was probably about 150, this one stuck with me the most, just sheerly based upon Georgina's performance as Justine. I thought she was absolutely exquisite, spellbinding, mesmerizing. The scene, particularly in the beginning, when she's with, as I refer to him, as a devil's wingman, Abaca or Abaca, I thought was just superbly acted, and just an amazing, amazing performance and film. I really enjoyed it.
And you, Mr. Mike?
Yeah, this is one that I missed for a lot of years, and I think I probably watched it for the first time earlier this year before we talked to Georgina about it. And since then, I've gone and tried to watch a lot of the sequels. I know we'll talk about that later on, but it took me by surprise because I had only seen Deep Throat, and so I guess I was kind of dreading watching Devil and Miss Jones, just because I'm not a huge Deep Throat fan. So, but once I watched it, I was like, okay, totally different direction. And you're right, her performance is remarkable in the film. There are times where it's tough for me to even realize that it's the same actress from scene to scene, just because she inhibits this persona in so many different ways. And yeah, really, it works, and it's a very touching film.
She almost seems possessed. I remember watching it, and particularly the second time, I thought she almost seemed possessed. She, as you said, she completely embodied the character. And I mean, she had a lot of different types of, you know, sort of acting to do. I mean, from the sexual to the dramatic to the, you know, just the bathtub scene, say, in the beginning. And I mean, she had a lot of different hats to wear in that. And, you know, to think that that was one of her very, very first performances in a sex film. But like you say, you watch it, or I felt, you don't really think of it as a sex film. You just think of it as a film that does contain some sexual scenes. And I know that they're plentiful, but I just think because it's Georgina, she just pulled it off and made it, you know, she elevated it, I believe, the material. And even though it was a well-written script and everything, and the musical score, I thought really did a lot to enhance the material as well.
I think one of the things that really does it for me with her is the fact that, not like modern porn starlets of today, she's not insanely busty. She's just a normal woman. And I think that the fact that she has that kind of look and that kind of appearance in that way about her really makes the story work even better.
She's a serious actress. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's funny. Last week I mentioned to you that I saw her, and I had recently, you guys will find this ridiculous, but I only saw Harold and Maude for the first time, mainstream film, about a month ago, because a good friend of mine had watched it. She always said, you got to see this. Well, when I watched it with Ruth Gordon, all I could think of was Georgina in that role. And that's just to lend to my comment about her being a very serious actress. And when you watch Devil, it's not a fun film. It's not a funny film. You have to take it seriously. And I think in large part because she is the leading role.
Well, that opening just kind of smacks you right in the face. You know, just her as this possessed being, you know, just, you know, she has been cursed and is, you know, so hungry for touching and for fulfillment and all this. And it just, that's what really took me by surprise when I put it in. At first I was like, oh, this must be the wrong file, or, you know, the disc must have started at the end or something like that, because it just kind of starts right in the middle of a scene and we eventually get back to it. But it was just like, wow. And it kind of sets the tone. I mean, we talked a few weeks ago about the opening to Who Can Kill a Child, and just the way that that kind of, you know, shocked both Rob and I with the beginning, this one wasn't as devastating as that, but there was definitely this kind of like, oh, okay, it kind of set the tone for me for a while and took me by surprise.
I also think it's a very daring choice to start with a close-up like that. Because the first image you get is her face, and she's talking, and she's just like, I can't do this by myself. You need to do this. You need to touch me, and I can't do all this.
If you touch me, I can get off. We'll get off together. If you just put your cock in me. Would you like to put your cock in me? Then we can get off. I can't do it by myself. Damn you, touch me, please. Damn you.
And we eventually learn, you know, as the film goes on, this is actually a bookend scene. And what's interesting to me is on the commentary on the DVD, he said that if he had a chance to make this today, Gerard Damiano, who obviously has passed away, but he said that he would have not opened the film with that. And to me, I go, it's just a perfect opening because it's kind of otherworldly. It's strange. You don't know what she's talking, you know, I mean, you got an idea of what she's talking about, but also he plays the man in that scene. And you don't really know what the hell he's talking about. It becomes more apparent as it goes on, like I said, with the end bookend scene. And you just get this feeling of, like you were saying, just sort of this hunger or this need that can't be fulfilled. And that's what opens up the film. And then it takes, and I looked at the timer on this, it takes 19 minutes from that first scene, which includes a little bit of masturbation on her end, to get to a full sex scene. That is amazing. That they would make you sit through a whole reel without putting that in, because everything, like we've talked about before with modern adult film, everything is so sort of, it's almost like the Joel Silver school of filmmaking. It has to have an explosion every 10 minutes. And in modern adult film, it's like, it has to have a sex scene at least every 10 minutes.
Yeah. And again, I didn't even realize, you know, she looks so different in that scene to me. Maybe it's just me. I don't know if you guys agree with this or not, but she looks physically transformed from that scene to where she is as this kind of virginal
Justine.
Just I was very shocked. I was like, is that her really? And then as it went along, I was like, yeah, that's really her. I matched up the voice and everything, but there was such a difference, of course, in the way that she carries herself and everything. It was really a remarkable transformation.
She looks like she's like a vamp in the opening scene, and then she's like the school marm, you know, and when she's meeting with Abaca, you know, she's wearing the white gloves and she's wearing sort of the lace and very prim and proper. And she just transforms herself throughout the film, you know, again, depending upon the material. And the fact that you mentioned that there's 19 minutes before a sex scene, I mean, they made the audience work for those sex scenes. They had to pay attention to the material and the dialogue and the mood of the film, which I think just that's what set it apart, I guess, at the time, obviously, and continues to do so today.
When you finally get into it, you know, once that 19 minutes is over, it then becomes very sex heavy, and we move into a series of scenes. And but the one thing that's really interesting is that the scenes build on each other, meaning that, you know, after she meets with Abaca and makes his deal, the first person she meets is the teacher. I think he calls himself the teacher, and it's Harry Reams. And each sex scene kind of builds on each other and gets more and more involved until you get to the last one, which is this like three-way. It is a three-way.
Right.
And you sort of get this idea that, much like we talked about when we did the opening of Misty Beethoven, I think Damiano, like Radley Metzger in that film, is able to use the sex to move the plot forward. Unlike a lot of hardcore adult films, a lot of times the sex grinds the plot to a halt. But in this situation, he's able to build each one so that it doesn't become so sort of like, oh, you know, now we got to take time out and have a sex scene and then we'll get back to the plot.
Right. Well, it's so central to the whole idea of her experiencing all of these earthly delights that she's been denied while she was on Earth. And just, you know, it really builds. I mean, to have the first person that she's having sex with be this kind of teacher role and, you know, introduce her to these things, and then she wants more and more, and that's how the film is giving it to us, is, you know, we're going to go to this type of sex, now this type of sex. And it's not like, you know, one type of sex is more extreme than another, but obviously, you know, a three-way is you know, you're getting out there a little bit more than a one-on-one or a girl-on-girl and this kind of stuff. So it was nice that it is building and building and building, and you also have a very good pace to it. Like you had mentioned there, you've got that 19 minutes of build-up where you really understand who Justine is and you really start to feel for her. So you're kind of taking this journey with her as she's going through. And I like the way that these sex scenes are paced, and it's not just, you know, bam, 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 though the sex scenes do seem to get closer and closer together as the movie builds along. So it's this nice idea of her getting more and more voracious as we, you know, as she's exploring herself and the world around her.
I think, too, that what I found really interesting is the evolution of Justine throughout the sex scenes. She goes from sort of a novice, you know, the teacher kind of initiates her into this whole world, breaks her down, so to speak.
I feel so foolish standing here like this.
Yes, I know.
Is that why you make me do it?
Yes.
What's that for?
To relax your muscle, you must hold it in. If it falls out, I'll punish you.
By the time she's with, you know, with the two men, Mark Stevens, and I think the other fellow, is it Levi Richards? Or she is the one in control. I felt that. Anyway, she went from sort of being in the student role to being sort of the one in control, where she was kind of telling them what she wanted.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah, all of it, all of you, all of you. Oh, God, yes, now harder and faster. Oh, fuck me, please, oh, please get me off, please get me off.
And I thought that was really, you know, interesting to the plot as well, and again made a good case for the sex scenes. You know, they sort of define the film instead of being fillers. You know, they kind of define the film all along.
And it's interesting that you talk about that, sort of this development of the character from the novice to, you know, basically from the student to the teacher. And I was thinking about the name of the character and listening to the commentary. He didn't bring it up, but, you know, the name Justine, well, Justine, what is it? It's Latin. It means justice, duh. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I was thinking about is, once again, our old friend, the Marquis de Sade, who had a book called Justine. And it was called Justine, The Misfortunes of Virtue. And the plot concerns this 12-year-old maiden who sets off in France and follows her until she's about 26 or so. And she's presented through all of these different sexual lessons. And what's interesting about the book is that this book was written, you know, in 1787, like a final version came out 10 years later. But this was a book that was a satire, actually, of another book that was written by a guy by the name of Samuel Richardson that was called Pamela or The Virtue Rewarded. And what was interesting about the de Sade book is it was originally published anonymously, but Napoleon found out about it and ordered the arrest of the author, who was de Sade, and he was incarcerated for 13 years due to this. And Napoleon supposedly called Justine the most abominable book ever engendered by the most depraved imagination, supposedly. I don't know if they've ever been able to track down if that was the exact quote. But the book was supposed to be destroyed by the Royal Court of France in 1815 because it was so depraved. So, but just the idea of the name Justine and all of this being the character name and sort of similarities to the idea of someone going through sexual lessons and everything. I haven't been able to find if Damiano used that on purpose or if he knew or if there was any connection in that way, but it did make for interesting corollary.
That's interesting. Well, there's a lot of symbolism throughout the film. I mean, just you take the snake scene, the serpent scene. I mean, Justine is, you know, biting into the apple and then the serpent appears. I mean, the symbolism, you know, to the Garden of Eden, it was just extraordinary the way it was done and, you know, kind of subtle at the same time. And she's, by that time in the film, I mean, she's just completely engaged. You know, there's no tentative, you know, behavior there. She's just completely comfortable in the role as this, you know, I guess seductress and temptress and all of these things. I just thought that there was, like you say, and just the same with the name, I thought that there was just a lot of symbolism throughout. And it's just very heavy on a lot of levels.
Yeah, and when you think about it, too, I mean, obviously the filmmaker, you know, Giorgio Damiano probably grew up, and matter of fact, he's talked about it in interviews, growing up Catholic and having all of these, you know, religious symbols, like you were talking about, the apple, the serpent, sort of the Catholic idea of killing yourself, because when she does meet with Mr. Abaca, she's a virgin.
What are you saying? Are you trying to tell me that I'm dead?
Yes, I'm sorry, but that's exactly what I was trying to avoid.
You're telling me that I'm dead, and you're trying to decide whether to send me up to heaven or down to hell.
Actually, I'm afraid that in your case, there is no choice.
Why not? What have I ever done that would warrant my being sent down there? Tell me one thing.
I'll admit that your record is quite good. As a matter of fact, in many ways, it's exceptional. But still, your accident, it's the one thing they will not forgive.
So there's all this stuff about, you know, Catholicism in some way, or at least in terms of Christianity in the Western canon and sort of how we would process it when we see these symbols and we understand what they mean.
Right. I'm just thinking about the comments that you made. Yeah, well, I think that too, and I just think, you know, the end of the film, which of course, as you said, is a bookend to the beginning, that's just so interesting as well. You know, she is, of course, Justine has become insatiable, I guess. She can't quell her thirst to be satiated. And he, of course, I mean, I just thought that was really an interesting scene. The two of them are locked in together, sort of in this eternal cell hell, which is what I called it in my review. And they're so detached, but yet they're thrown together. And I just thought that was, you know, that the hell, of course, being the, you know, coming after the sampling of the apple, so to speak, and then being condemned again, the symbolism, you know, the Catholic symbolism being condemned sort of to this life of, you know, this horrible endless existence of never being able to be sort of quenched, or, you know, is sort of in your own private hell, depending on what happened in your life or what happened in your, you know, in this case, you know, when she had requested that she has to have this extended time on earth, and this is what she gets. So this is kind of her punishment, so to speak. I just thought, yeah, that sort of tied in with the scenes that we saw earlier, you know, building and building and building upon these sort of symbolic, you know, ideas and you know, religious ideas and ideals.
And if you look at all of the scenes before then, like everything is ornate, you know, everything is full of stuff. And when you get to this, it's a white room. It's very institutional. They're both in black clothes. And just sort of this devoid of things in the final scene. And I also liked how she keeps, you know, begging him and begging him to, like, touch her. And he's almost like this Renfield kind of character.
Yeah.
Where he just keeps going on about the bugs and the roaches and the rats.
Why?
Yeah, and they're just talking past each other. Like, they're not communicating at all.
I close my eyes. I pretend I'm asleep. You must sit very still. Pretend you're asleep. Then he comes out.
It seems like a silly waste of time. Pretending you're asleep so you can hear a fly. See what I have for you? It's all wet, juicy. You see how the juice flows out of my heart, cunt?
You don't think it's important? You think I'm crazy?
Oh, give me your tongue. I want you to lick my cunt. Stick your fingers in here.
He's here. Somewhere. I know it. Don't you see? I must pretend.
My favorite scene in the whole movie. It's just phenomenal.
Yeah, and I was looking at it several different ways, and one is that it almost kind of seems and this may be a leap, is that the real hell is when people can't connect. The real hell, you know, is our lives to some extent. Because if you think about it, like before, she was disconnected. You know, she was not there with anyone, she's, you know, and all this, and then ends up killing herself. And then in the end, it's sort of the same thing where, you know, the question is, were you as bad off in the apartment as where you are at the very end of the film? And also I was thinking about, and this is just on another thing too, is that she's sitting on this box and it looks like a hope chest or something.
And I never noticed that.
And I was thinking about it as another symbol, sort of like Pandora's box, right? You know, you open it up, you got to pay the price for opening it up, right? So things just sort of coming together. And this idea of, you know, hell as this, you know, claustrophobic little room. It's not devils and pitchforks and fire and brimstone. It's very austere.
Yeah, they're both kind of imprisoned by their own obsessions and motivations and fears. And I think a lot of people can relate to that as kind of a modern day explanation or interpretation of hell. And yet this was made, you know, 40 years ago, and that's not that long ago, but I think that probably is absolutely more terrifying than the idea of pitchforks, I think, and darkness, and just like you say, and the inability to communicate. And I mean, they didn't need to be in a room with one another because virtually they were alone. They really were alone. They weren't connecting, like you say, at all. And that's pretty terrifying.
I don't know if it was just that the print that I watched was kind of, I don't know, soft, or if it was shot this way, but really, so much of the film feels very dreamlike. It feels like it's kind of soft around the edges on purpose. And I think a lot of that, too, as far as, you know, nightmare at the end and the beginning, but more of a dream throughout the middle. I think that the score really lends to that, too. It's just this kind of, you know, there's some really very nice melodies through it. And it really kind of takes you in and leads you through, you know, we talked about this journey of Justine as she's going through and becoming more and more voracious, but really the score helps pull you along as well. You know, it's not just this kind of bomb chicka wah wah kind of score. It really, you know, it envelops you and really kind of, I don't know, there are some very pretty melodies that you will, you know, hum for a long time afterwards.
And especially the song over the suicide scene, which to me really highlights her mental state and her thoughts, because it's not explained why she kills herself. We don't see a note. She doesn't say anything to anyone. There's really no dialogue during that. As a matter of fact, there isn't. I can't even think of anything she says, or if she even, you know, says anything when she's slitting her wrist. And that song really kind of plays in to explain this mental state of the person, and it just works wonderfully.
I can't wait one more day, can't find one more word to say, so I'll just get on my way. I'm coming.
Yeah, I can't remember. It was a female vocalist, and I can't remember what she was singing, but I remember the time thinking she is kind of like, I guess, echoing Justine's physical actions, I think, and sort of almost egging her on. It was just kind of a reflection of Justine's inner thoughts. I found a lot of the musical score very foreboding, though. Like, it certainly is not happy. It was almost disturbing, I felt, when I was watching it. It was prickly. It kind of made the hairs on my back stand on end.
And it's such a, I hate to use this term because it makes it sound like it's a bad thing, but it is a downer ending. And when when we talk about adult film, usually, I mean, and even the film before this that he did, you know, Deep Throat, Damiano made, is such a fun movie. It's like humorous, and there's jokes, and there's rockets going off, and fireworks, and all this stuff. It's like Devil and Miss Jones is the complete 180 of it. And it is so, like you said, it's like a horror film in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
It's terrifying in a lot of ways. I loved it that Damiano appeared in himself, you know, in those scenes. I just thought that was a brilliant stroke. And he's very believable, you know, kind of as her foe in those scenes. You know, you know, I can't remember. I guess I'd seen a couple of other films in which he appeared, but this was a pretty, you know, fairly lengthy scene. And I thought, like I said, I thought he was very believable and, you know, equally as kind of frightening. And, it, you know, really left you thinking about sort of mortality and the whole idea of this kind of heaven and hell concept. And, you know, I just thought the thing was written well, it was executed well, acted well, you know, it was just quite an interesting, fascinating film. As you say, we have to say for a porn film, but really, like, when you watch it, you are not, that is not present on your mind.
And that was the great thing about a lot of the reviews. If you go back and you read the reviews from the times, I mean, mainstream reviews, New York Times, Roger Ebert,
right,
things like that, they thought this is like the best adult film they'd ever seen.
Yeah, that is when it's really what changed everything, I think. You know, even though I'm thinking Behind the Green Door, I know that was released, maybe it was just a year before, that was very sort of fantasy in a lot of ways. This smacks you more, like we were saying, in the face. That one, this is the one I think that really set things apart and really made the world kind of take notice to this, you know, these erotic films that were being made by very talented directors.
The one thing, if you want to talk about a theme between the two of them, and it's kind of hard to find a theme between Deep Throat and Devil and Miss Jones, but I think if there's one theme that Damiano comes to in these two films, and I can't say that I'm familiar with all of the hardcore films that he did, is that he seems to put a premium on women finding pleasure. And there's a scene in which towards the end, she's walking with Mr. Abaca, and she's like, you know, how much time do I have?
For the first time in my life, for the first time, I found contentment. How much time do I have?
Enough to do what you came for.
Could you...
What? Ask them to let you stay?
Yes.
To live out the time you had allotted?
Yes.
The time you wasted when you took your life?
Yes, please. Oh, please. I'll do anything. Everything.
You'll do that now, without any concessions. No, what you ask is quite impossible. My voice is nothing. My thoughts are nothing. In many respects, I'm like you. Nothing.
And, of course, Deep Throat is all about this woman who's not happy with sex, and then, well, of course, because she's made differently, and
right,
finds out that, you know, by doing the act, she can find the pleasure. So he seems to have a thing with that, which I think is kind of unique when we talk about hardcore film, because a lot of times people go, well, hardcore film is very exploitive to women, it's all male, male, mm-hmm, male. And I think that he kind of turns it from an angle and makes you reexamine that idea.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. Definitely agree. I think that, you know, I'm just, you know, I think of so many of the films that I've seen, and I think there's probably somewhat of a balance there between filmmakers who were trying to, you know, kind of show that, you know, the female pleasure side of things. And, you know, I think that they always tried to strike a balance, but obviously, I mean, they're made by men. You know, the market was geared towards men, again, obviously, but... You know, there was, I would say that Damiano definitely had a sensitivity there, and a few other filmmakers, you know, during his era, his contemporaries as well. But, you know, the women that I interviewed, you know, for my book, I would say that most of them felt that there was sort of a focus on the female element in that regard, which I think is really important. I think it's maybe was more consistent with their era, though. I don't know so much about today. I think that there was a shift, you know, moving towards the female pleasure zone and all of those things. And maybe Damiano was one of the first filmmakers to kind of, you know, get the ball rolling there. But that is definitely, yes, I would agree. It was his films, I think, would stand out that way. But again, I think a lot of his contemporaries followed suit or were trying to do the same thing on some level.
Yeah, now there's such a premium put onto the cum shot that it's just, you know, absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I don't think that something like a Bukkake film could exist in the 70s, and I'm kind of glad for that. You know, I like this, as you put it, the focus on women, and, you know, to your point, to Rob's point, you know, just this, that Justine is our main character, and it's not just things happening to her. It is her as an active participant and seeking these things out. And she really is the focus of the film for good reason.
Yeah, they could have, I mean, Damiano could have hired a male lead and had him seeking pleasure and all these different, but no, his lead is a female. And I think that's significant. Like you were saying, I think that's very significant. And she is the one ultimately who is in control. And again, that was kind of a monumental thing, definitely.
Yeah, and I saw that in some of his other films as well, with like Memories Within Miss Aggie. You know, that one definitely a very heavy woman focus in that. That one's got an interesting twist to it, though, that I won't give away for folks that want to check that one out. But that one's definitely an interesting film as well. And I mean, he really... I don't know. I've seen some bad Damiano films, and I've seen some really good ones. And, you know, I've seen Let My Puppets Come, which I wasn't really, you know, super thrilled with. But though it was unusual, you know, having a kind of Muppet porn film, but, you know, years and years before Meet the Feebles. But, yeah, but he did some very interesting things along the way in his career.
And, you know, when I think about it, I was just watching Inside Deep Throat, the documentary that came out a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the idea of women's pleasure, maybe the reason why he was focused on that was because he used to be a hairdresser. And he talks about in the interviews about being a hairdresser in the documentary, about how women eventually, you know, when you're doing their hair, they'll open up to you and tell you about their life and their love life and their boyfriends and their husbands and things like that. And maybe there was a part of him that understood where that side was coming from. So he wasn't so male focused in a way. He was a little bit more open than maybe some other directors were, you know, this is all about me kind of idea. I'm telling the story that I want, as opposed to a story that would be of interest maybe to the ladies he was doing the hair for.
Yeah, there definitely seemed to be much more of a focus on couples as an audience, as opposed to just the lonely guy kind of thing.
Raincoat Brigade.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's when couples, I mean, that was really a turning point, because that's when couples would go out to the premieres. Oh, okay, well, this is acceptable. You know, women are taking, they're part of the equation here. So now it's more acceptable for couples. And you know, that again, you know, tying in with the porno chic era, when it became very, you know, she to go to a porn film, as, you know, friends would go and see them. And prior to the early 70s, that never would have happened. I mean, it really opened up the door to a lot of, you know, where the films could be embraced by all kinds of groups and ages and gender and everything. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that women were, again, taken into consideration and made part of the film.
I think we talked about it before on one of the other episodes, but I'm always reminded of that scene in Taxi Driver.
Yeah, with her, with Travis and Betsy going into the movie theater.
Yeah, exactly. You know, lots of couples come to these movies.
You gotta be kidding.
What?
This is a dirty movie.
No, this is a movie that a lot of couples come to. All kinds of couples go here.
You sure about that?
Yeah, I see them all the time.
No, you don't understand. Yeah.
I haven't seen that in so long, I don't remember the scene.
It's very uncomfortable as he's trying to talk her into going into a porn theater.
On the first date.
On a first date, yes.
Well, yeah. That's different. You have to wait till the third date for something like that.
There you go.
Let's take a break and hear an interview with Gerard Damiano Jr., the son of the filmmaker, and also Miss Jones herself, actress Georgina Spelvin.
Excuse me, what are you doing? Are you looking for porn again?
No.
Well, what is that I see?
It's not porn. It's the badassboobsandbodycounts.com website. I happen to be looking at the reviews in the boobs section of the site.
They have a section of the site dedicated to boobs?
Yes, they do. They cover exploitation films in the boobs category, action films in the badass category, and horror in the body counts category.
What's that other option? BBNBC podcast?
If you're not into reading the reviews, you can listen to them via the web on your mobile device through iTunes, and they cover the same types of films, lesser known action, exploitation, and horror cinema. So yeah, to answer your question, I wasn't cruising porn.
That's too bad.
What's too bad?
That you weren't cruising for porn.
Why?
Because I was feeling kind of horny.
Oh, wait, get back here. Hey, get back here.
Life is so busy. From my job to my family and all the things in between,
Sometimes you need to make a little time for yourself. And I found something nice to make those times oh so sweet. It's Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women, men, and couples. And if you're new to all this, they have plenty of helpful suggestions and information to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has taken your privacy seriously. Go to the site and read all about it. And right now, when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order from Vibrators.com's huge catalog. That's Vibrators.com. Do something nice for you.
GGTMC live for you, fresh air. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that fucking burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst fucking piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Generally, he wanted to make more serious films that dealt with a more serious subject matter. And so this became a perfect vehicle for that exploration.
Now, this was the film he made right after Deep Throat, right?
Actually, I believe that there was another lesser-known film that he made in between, but it was more along the same lines of Deep Throat. And Devil and Miss Jones represented for him more of a departure from light comedy into something more serious, which is really what he aspired to do.
Right, yeah, which there is such a tonal shift in it. It's just, it's pretty remarkable that the same guy made both films. You know, it's fantastic. I think it's kind of a triumph, you know. Did the success of Deep Throat make it possible for Devil, or was it still like a struggle for him to make this film?
It certainly helped him in a number of ways. One is that he was just learning on Deep Throat, certainly, and he continued to learn throughout his career. So he was always making better and better films as he went. So, you know, certainly the experience that he gained on Deep Throat and the other films to follow helped him to make Devil. But also the acclaim that Deep Throat garnered allowed him to find an audience. And when he made Deep Throat, it was a light comedy. You know, he couldn't have made Devil and Miss Jones at that time because he felt, and I don't think he was wrong in assuming that audiences weren't ready, you know, to take on a sex film that was also, you know, a serious exploration. You know, he believed that part of the success of Deep Throat was due to the fact that it was a light comedy and very accessible, and it helped to create, you know, what we now refer to as a porno chic era, where now there was a mainstream audience for his films, so they were ready for Devil and Miss Jones by the time it came out.
You know, you said that your dad was constantly learning as he was making films, and you could definitely see that. For him, what was his favorite thing that he did?
A film called The Story of Joanna was his greatest film. He was very proud of Devil and Miss Jones. You know, he felt that that was more the kind of film he wanted to make, but he continued to, you know, to make more ambitious films. And I think that his masterpiece was The Story of Joanna. Now, unfortunately, what happened was that by the time that film came out, the so-called golden era of porn was drawing to an end. And there was an industry now, which had never been before. When my father first started making films, he aspired to be a filmmaker. He didn't aspire to be a pornographer. I mean, it wasn't even a career choice at that time. You know, you couldn't have a career in that. And so, by the time The Story of Joanna came out, video became accessible. And there was a decline in the industry in general. The newly created industry, now was turning out lesser and lesser films. So he found that it was harder for him to get bigger budgets. It was harder for him to get real actors because now there was an industry that was churning out one-day wonders. So, you know, unfortunately, the films that he made in the latter part of his career happened in that world, when now there was an industry.
You said on a recent episode of the Rialto Report that you're working on restoring your father's films. Can you tell us where you are in that process?
Well, it's been a long process for my sister and myself to collect a number of the elements and put together all the missing pieces of his greatest films. Now, he'll always be known for Deep Throat, and he never denied the success that it afforded him, but he never pretended that that was a great film. I mean, he didn't feel it was a great film, and as we said, he certainly went on to make better ones, and he'd much rather be remembered for those films. And, you know, we're working on helping to bring those films out in the state that he intended them to be seen.
Did your dad share any memories of the making of Devil and Miss Jones with you?
Well, absolutely. Yes, he did. I had the privilege to watch the film together with him not long before he passed away. And so I got a chance to not only see it with him, but see it with him when he hadn't seen the film in 35 years. So it was almost as if he was seeing it for the first time. And, you know, he was really, really impressed with Georgina Spelvin. I mean, he always loved her. He always had a lot of respect for her. But after so much time had passed, seeing the film again and watching her performance, he was just in awe. And especially for him seeing this industry that had been created and how things had changed in a very short time, he was amazed to find an actress who was an actress, who was also willing to do hardcore films as opposed to somebody who was just there, you know, to perform sex that had no acting ability or even interest. And he was amazed to watch her do these scenes where she would go through two or three pages of dialogue while getting fucked. She put it, can I say this? I mean, am I going to get bullied for this? But yes, he was impressed by that because watching later films, not his films in particular, but just later films in the industry, it was hard to find somebody in his words, he would say, you couldn't find an actress that could walk and chew gum at the same time. So to find somebody even to perform lines, period, was difficult, you know, by the end of his career. So the later films, the sex is not scripted. You know, there's just a place that says sex scene, or, you know, when I was writing screenplays, we would just write industrial scene here, okay, where because you didn't know what the capabilities of the actress might be, and I use that term loosely because, you know, later with the advent of the adult film industry, they're porn stars. There's no porn actresses. If you're in a movie, you're a porn star. There's no middle ground. So you never knew the capabilities of people you would be working with, so you couldn't give them anything too ambitious. Now, the sex scenes in The Devil and Miss Jones are all scripted. Every word was written and memorized and performed. And unlike films that you would see later, there's a seamlessness to this film in that Georgina Selvin carries her role from scene to scene to scene with the same intensity. Whereas when you watch other films, after the dialogue, when it's almost as if the film shifts gears, when they move over to the bed or start the sex scene, it's as if everything happened just goes out the window and they do a sex scene and then that's over and let's pick up the dialogue. But in Devil and Miss Jones, she keeps performing from beginning to end in the film. And you see that every line, every expression on her face, whether she's just doing her lines or whether she's having sex, it still portrays that character and still drives that story home. And my father had said that he never met an actress before or since that could have played that role and with such intensity. And also, let me ask you, because I don't know if in the scope of your show you've talked about Alden Schumann, who composed the soundtrack.
No, I haven't.
Well, I think that's something that's significant in this film, in that Alden Schumann's soundtrack for The Devil and Miss Jones is considered to be one of the 100 top soundtracks in film, period. And I think that's ironic in that porn films are infamous for their bad music. And so to think that that a porn film actually has produced an original soundtrack that's considered among the best is significant. And it, for my father, it was the first film that he did that actually had all original music in it that was composed for the film.
How did he find his composer?
It started in that he had hoped to do the opening scene to the song Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon Garfunkel. So he actually went ahead and cut the scene to that music. And, of course, it was very difficult, and then he found it possible to get the rights to use that music. So he was looking for someone to compose a piece of music in that same vein that had that same tone for the suicide scene. And that's how he met Alden Schumann. And, once they started working together, then, he just ran with the whole film and composed original music for the whole show, which then resulted in a soundtrack album, which again was unprecedented to have a soundtrack album for a porn film. So that's something that my father was very proud of.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised when I saw that there was a soundtrack album out there. And at first I was like, oh, it's probably some bootleg or whatever. But yeah, it was great. It's a wonderful soundtrack and it really kind of stands on its own.
Yes, that it does.
How was the film received when it came out?
Well, it did receive some critical acclaim. People did go to see it, and I won't say that it got all good reviews, but it was reviewed as a film, and that's something that my father was very proud of, that the critics of the day, Pauline Kael and even Siskel and Ebert and so forth, reviewed the film, and spoke about it as film. They didn't all rave about it, but they didn't talk about it as a sex film. And my father was proud to say that he didn't make sex films. He made films with sex in them.
My co-host was very curious about this, and so am I. As far as, has Deep Throat ever been considered for the Library of Congress National Film Registry? Because, it really kind of started the entire porno chic movement, and it really is this kind of culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant film. Have you ever heard from them?
No, I have not. Although I would welcome that discussion. I think that would do my father a great honor.
So, if folks are interested in learning more about your father's work or the work that you're doing with the restorations, is there a place where they can go to find that out?
Yes. Well, the website and so forth is all in the works, but the best place is at this point would be at the Rialto Report, that I'm in touch with them and they will be announcing these developments as they occur.
Perfect. Well, we will be sure to link over to those guys.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak on my father's behalf.
We're very honored to have you, and I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your interest. What can I tell you that you don't already know?
Oh, geez. Well, we've got a whole list of questions. Robbie, you want to start diving in?
Sure.
As
for your background, you know, when did you first get into performance and acting, and what do you remember as some of your early roles?
The first memory I have of being on stage was at the age of 2.5. I was elected to play Dopey in the dancing school recital, and I was just so pleased because I felt that was a very special role, and my father was mortified. But I think I got it because my mother could make the costume, to tell the truth.
That's excellent.
That's really what you wanted to know. Yeah, my grandmother would take a great effort to get my mother, her children, to any kind of performance that came anywhere near the small South Texas town where they were born. That was Victoria. And mother fell in love with dancing when she saw Pavlova dance. And so, of course, as soon as I was born, I was any town she where they my mother and dad moved all the time. But any town, after finding a good butcher, she would see if there was a dancing school.
So how young were you when you first got enrolled in dance?
Well, 2.5, 3 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd always, any dancing school in town, that was the first stop. And I went to, I went pro. I actually got my first paying job in 1954 at the Dallas State Fair Music Hall, which put on wonderful productions of Broadway shows every summer as a summer stock thing. And they would bring star names in to do the lead roles, but they hired a chorus that did every show all summer long, a singing chorus and a dancing chorus. And I was lucky enough to get into the dancing chorus that year in 1954. And from there, I went with a couple of the other dancers that were in that company to New York in that fall, and we tried out for every ballet company and nobody got a job. We tried out for every Broadway show and nobody got a job. And everybody else went home, but I stayed and I got a job at the Latin Quarter. The Latin Quarter in those days had three. Do you know what that is, the Latin Quarter? That was a nightclub that was at Times Square. And it was a very hot item in like the early 50s. So they had floor shows, 3 shows a night, 4 shows on Saturday. And they served dinner. They had, it was very elegant, you know, linen tablecloths and silver and crystal and stuff. And all of the D's, Dim, and Do's guys all went there, you know, with their dates, you know. And I got a job in the as a pony. They had 3 level of girls. They had the show girls who had to be over 6 feet tall and strong enough to wear 50-pound headdresses, you know, because that's about all they wore. But they had to wear these huge headdresses. And then they had a group called the models, which were 5'6" to 6'. And then they had a group called the ponies, which were under 5'6". That did the actual hard dancing. So I got a job as a pony. And then in the course of my tenure there, they asked me to cover.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth Archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.